Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it. Well, I and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. It's a beautiful day outside. It's not too bad. The humidity is better. And we are here with the author of The Washington Operator. Alan Topol is here, and we are going to have a great show. We're going to talk about his series with Kelly Cameron. Good morning. How you doing?
Morning. How are you, Fran? Good.
Hanging in there, I hope.
Good. Helmet's here.
So tell us how
I'm here, Fran.
Oh, good. I was getting worried.
Go ahead, Fran.
Tell us how you created the prologue to set the stage for what is coming. Tell us about how you set the prologue. And tell us about Kelly Cameron and how you created her.
It's okay, we'll do it later. Well, I got Kelly Cameron. It's interesting because you and I have worked together on a number of books. So I was using Craig Page, and hey, you loved Craig Page, and I loved Craig Page through six books. But then I decided to make a change of pace in a book called The Washington Power Play, which came out exactly a year before this book. And I introduced Kelly Cameron. She's an FBI agent, rising agent within the Bureau, single mom. She had then a 10-year-old daughter who's now 12 in the Washington Operator. She's gutsy. She's bold. She's trying to make a success of herself in the FBI, which is a male-dominated organization. So that's what I got onto Kelly. And I really liked her a lot in Washington Power Play. And readers liked her, which is even better. So then I decided to bring her back in the Washington Operator. And I had great fun with her. And I hope you liked her too, Fran.
Oh, I like her. She's interesting. She's a lot like me. She goes after what she wants, and she doesn't stop until she gets it, which is me.
I think that's actually a good way to put it with Kelly. She goes after what she wants. Hey, and she's constantly fighting and being in trouble with the Washington male-dominated bureaucracy, and there's no other way to say it. I mean, it really is sort of unfortunate, but that's kind of what happens to her. And she struggles and does a good job, but she does okay. And I really have come to be attached to Kelly. Of course, we have some romance in this book, but we don't want to give away the plot. We have some action. Kelly's life is threatened. Kelly's daughter's threatened, but we don't want to give away any of that in the book.
No, I'm being very good about this. So tell us about Jim Forrester. What's her relationship with him?
Well, Forrester is the FBI director, and he likes Kelly a lot, and he wants to advance Kelly. Forrester recognizes that he doesn't have any women who are in a comparable position, who are rising. And he likes Kelly because she is willing to take on challenges. She's willing to take risks, and she will move forward and do whatever is required to get a situation done. So he likes her a lot. But their relationship also has some stormy issues in the Washington Operator, because Kelly, since she's determined to get what she wants, she is of the view that a Chinese intelligence agent who she has been monitoring and working with is planning something big that will affect the United States. And she wants to move against this Chinese intelligence agent because she has a score to pay from him, from the Fryer book. And Kelly then sets up a surveillance over Thanksgiving weekend without getting the prior approval or even without the knowledge of her boss, Jim Forrester, the FBI director. He's off in Hawaii for Thanksgiving vacation, having a wonderful time, and unknown to him, Kelly, working with a CIA agent that she's worked with before, sets up the surveillance in Paris on this Chinese intelligence agent. And at that point, when Forrester gets back from his vacation in Hawaii and Kelly tells him about what's happened, then he is really angry at her, and I think justifiably so. She went out on a very, very long limb, following her guts, following her instinct to try to snare this Chinese intelligence official. And that causes her to have a real disagreement with Forrester. They smooth it over eventually because he likes her. He's willing to forgive her. And because fortunately for Kelly, her intelligence thing paid off and she was able to land this what she wanted from this Chinese intelligence agent. And what she learned on this Thanksgiving weekend surveillance is what set in motion the entire plot for the Washington operator.
Yeah, it does. So we have Adam McCabe, and he helps her out. And what does China have planned? And what does the Washington operator is George Corbin. What does he have to do with this? I don't like this guy at all.
No, good. Okay, I'm glad. If you don't like my villains, then I'm a happy friend.
No, but that's good, because that means they did their job.
Absolutely. Let me give your listener a three sentence, as they say in the business, the elevator pitch of the Washington operator. China and Iran are conspiring to take over the Saudi Arabian oil fields and to take over Saudi Arabia in a bold move. So it's two U.S. enemies, China and Iran, coming together. They are assisted in their plot by George Corbin, who's a Washington lobbyist. He's greedy, he's venal, he's everything. He's as bad as the people that your listeners are reading about in the newspaper as a Washington lobbyist. And their effort to take over the Saudi Arabia and its oil fields are thwarted by Kelly Cameron, is right in the middle of this. Now, along the way, for a little bit of side action, I have a 40-year-long romance between an Israeli Mossad agent, Esther, and an Iranian official who's involved in the Iranian Foreign Service. But that's basically the elevator pitch. That's the Washington operator. And as you said, it's called the Washington operator because at the heart of it is this evil, greedy, venal lobbyist, George Corbin.
Well, that's interesting. And can you still hear me?
Yep, absolutely.
Oh, okay, good, because I just logged in myself from another phone just so I can talk on two phones at once. Why does he meet with the Chinese foreign minister, and why does he agree with his plan?
Why does Corbin meet with the Chinese? Okay,
yeah.
Corbin is the Chinese lure Corbin into becoming part of the plot. The reason is that the Chinese know that if they are going to join with the Iranians and make this move against Saudi Arabia and Saudi oil, there's a chance that the United States will get in and will try and block them. So they hire Corbin because they know that Corbin has access to important people in Washington, on the Hill, in the administration, and also university professors who influence public opinion. And they want Corbin to help them influence the United States so it does not intervene on the side of Saudi Arabia. So it lets them proceed with what they want to do. Now, Corbyn initially doesn't want to do this because he realizes this is basically treason from the United States. Mm-hmm. But the Chinese are smart. They've done their homework, and they know that Corbyn has been acting illegally. He has been representing the government of Iran, and he has been representing them and obtaining money to influence their affairs in Washington without registering as a foreign agent. In fact, he couldn't because he would need approval because of Iranian sanctions. So he's already violated lots of American laws with his existing representation of Iran. They know this. They also know that Corbyn is desperate for money. He has a very expensive lifestyle with four homes around the world. He's been through three bitter divorces, which have cost him extensively. He's now dating and planning to marry a Hollywood actress, and he needs money desperately, and the Chinese know this. So the Chinese have Corbyn over a barrel, and as a result of having Corbyn over a barrel, the Chinese are now able to get him to do their calling. So that's basically what happens.
Oh, wow. So we have two other players in this thing. We have Lu Tuan and Chiang. What do they have to say about this?
Well, the other officials in China, Chinese officials who are working with Kelly Cameron, and they are in the U.S. They are working the Chinese intelligence agent from the U.S. side. And, you know, this is a point you and I have talked about a number of my books, Fran, and I always try to work in what's really happening in the world, which I try to do in the Washington Operator, Geopolitical Affairs. And what's happening in this book is that Chinese intelligence, and there's extensive Chinese intelligence in the United States. You know, people are always focused on what the Russians are doing in the United States. The Russians are spying. The Russians are influencing U.S. elections. The Russians are doing this. The Russians are doing that. But what I focus on in my new book, The Washington Operator, is the fact that the Chinese are doing extensive spying in the United States. Now, this people say, well, where did you get this from? Did you make this up? Where's this come from? And, you know, I've read extensively in this subject, and it's real. It's what they're doing. And then I just picked up a book about a couple weeks ago called To Catch a Spy, The Art of Counterintelligence by James Olson, a former chief of the CIA, counterintelligence. And this book, and so we've got Olson, who's been at the high level of the U.S. CIA counterintelligence, and he flatly declares that it's the Chinese who are doing the largest amount of spying in the United States. They're dwarfing what the Russians are doing. And it's really this fact, this information, that's at the heart of my book, The Washington Operator, because they have the agents who are out there working with and assisting George Corbyn, and then going head-to-head with my character, Kelly Cameron, in The Washington Operator.
Well, what I appreciate is the fact that this is not about a terrorist attack. And I have been getting so many books on terrorism and terrorist attack that I'm going to do a show in October. I'm waiting for the person to agree to do this with me on our books, a blueprint for what happens in the news and in real life. It's an idea that I have because your books are, you know, are real, and they don't promote anything on, you know, it's what happens in the news. But when I'm reading these books on, I just picked up a book called The Healer's Daughters by Jay Emberg. And the first chapter has nothing to do with anything, and the rest of it, three chapters are how you actually create a terrorist attack and how this guy actually went and did it. So I'm just wondering, I'm going to do a show, I think, on the blueprint, or books, a blueprint, and plot lines, and the media, a blueprint for what happens and what makes people do things. I think that would be
different. That will be different and will be an interesting topic. But you're right. My book does not deal with a terrorist attack. In fact, This is a 15th novel, Washington Power Play. None of them deal with terrorist attacks. Lots of writers do. I'm operating in a different sort of sphere, and I don't want to say I have a bit of a niche, but I do have a bit of a niche because I'm dealing with, and it's true in the Washington Operator, I'm dealing with geopolitical affairs in the world. I'm dealing with world politics.
Yeah.
I'm dealing with individuals that are caught up in it. It's not a classic spy book, but it's an effort sort of to influence what's happening in the world. And I have a goal. My major, major goal in writing, and this is true for all my 15 books, I want the reader to be entertained. I want him or her to turn pages as quickly as they can, take the book to the beach, a good beach read. But at the end of the day, I also want the reader to come away and say, hey, I learned something from this book. And that's what I'm striving to do. So that's really what's happening.
It is, because you know how many of them? I have like 30 books on my chair inside, seriously. And some of them I don't know I'm getting. They're surprising me. And I just got a few that I said, oh, my God, what is that? And they all deal with the same topic. And after a while, I don't want to read them anymore. And it's upsetting.
Yeah, I have the same feeling,
Okay. Yeah, and I'm listening to the news yesterday, and I'm saying, like, I wonder if this kid actually, you know, read a book or listened to the news or actually did research. It's scary. So let's get back to McCabe. Why McCabe is killed, and why is Richard Weller brought in, and how is he connected to Adam? That was interesting.
Yeah, okay. So what happens, and I sort of bring together these two strands. Because this is the hook that gets Kelly hooked up in the United States with what's going on with Corbin, is that McCabe is a young university student at my fictitious university, Meriwether, which is on the eastern shore of Maryland. McCabe is a student who ends up, because he's having an illicit affair with the wife of one of his professors. He's studying Middle Eastern history, and he's at a hotel having an affair with the wife of one of his professors, and McCabe ends up through quite accidentally. There's a conference going on at that hotel in which one of the professors at the university is assisting in the plot involving the Chinese and the Iranians. And as a result of overhearing what they're doing, McCabe is murdered. McCabe has a very good friend, a fellow student at Meriwether University, by the name of Weller. And Weller then joins forces. Kelly seeks out Weller because she's trying to find out what happened to McCabe. So it makes sense that she would seek out McCabe's best friend, which she does. And as a result of that, she gets hooked up with Weller, and then they have their own relationship and their own romance. So that's what happens with Weller.
Well, she better watch out, seriously. I want to get mixed up with the wrong person. I know.
Weller's a good character. I like Weller. He's a former CIA agent. He's a good
guy. I really do.
I like Weller a lot. Weller's a good guy.
So we have Lou, who's horrible, and he's dangerous, and we have Professor Kamal. So how does Broad Corbin fit into blackmailing this poor professor who has no chance about anything, and he's just trying to do his job, the poor thing, but not really?
Right, not really, as you say, because Corbin, and this also is something that I think I've gotten really positive feedback from readers from the Washington Operator about this, but what happened was that Corbyn has realized that in the United States, and this is real as well, American opinion can be influenced by what happens on college campuses. It can be influenced by what professors do. It can be influenced by the protests on campuses. And Corbyn, evil Corbyn, is smart. He wants to utilize this influence of public opinion that that professors and others and campuses can do. So his job is to create the protests on college campuses that will influence the United States not to intervene in the China-Iranian effort to take over Saudi Arabia. And I loved working this part of the problem, and I've got great feedback because what goes on in college campuses and the protests and stuff in some situations can be manipulated, and that's what Corbyn does. He hires a group of professors to essentially manipulate American public opinion on college campuses, and I had a lot of fun creating that part of the plot, and I've gotten really kind of positive feedback from readers of the Washington Operator about that part of the plot.
Well, I agree with you. My nephew was telling me a couple of times, when he just graduated and he's actually working as an investment banker, first job, and he said a lot of times there were protests, a lot of times there were, you know, threats. He said, and they were real. He said, and it was like he got used to it after a while. But he didn't participate
That's
in anything
right.
like that because he knows better than to upset his aunt or doing anything like that. He would never do that. But he said it's real. So this is really mind-boggling. Seriously? They offered him $20 million a year for his financial status is in question because his wives were smart. They really got him good. I mean, if you want to know how to get somebody, this is really good. So why would they offer him $20 million for that? That's insane. And the girl he's engaged to, well, I don't think he really cares about her either that much.
Right. I think you're right, but, you know, when you hit on with the money, the $20 million being insane, you've now hit on one of the other things that is at the heart of the Washington Lawyer that I'm really focused on, and that's, you know, in the last 10 years, we've had globalization in the United States, I mean in the world, in the economy, and what globalization has meant is, gee, the whole world is much more integrated on economic affairs, on business, and so forth. But I have been in Washington for a long time, more than 30 years as a lawyer with a large Washington law firm the same time I've been writing these novels. And what has also happened in the United States as well in these last 10 years is there has been a huge influx of foreign money coming into the United States. And this foreign money is a different thing that we never had before. It's money coming from the Middle East, coming from Russia, from China. It's money that's coming into the United States to influence what the American government does, to influence what our Congress does, to influence what the executive branch does, this huge amount, this swell of foreign money. So, you know, I don't want to get into politics of the of the current administration. I really don't want to get into that. But I will say one thing is the current president said when he came in, he wanted to drain the swamp. Well, the swamp hasn't been drained. If anything, the swamp has been increased because what this is this huge swell of foreign money coming into the United States. And this is one of the things I want to focus on in the Washington Operator. And I want the reader to understand it. It doesn't matter who's in office, Republicans, Democrats, this one or that one, is what has changed in the world in the last 10 years is that foreign governments are pouring money into Washington They're hiring the best lobbyists they can get, and they are trying to influence the American government to take policies that are favorable to them. And this is something that I don't think the Congress has properly focused on. I don't think the American government's focused on. We have a law that requires registration if you're a foreign agent. Those laws haven't been enforced very well. And so this is a serious problem, and I try to bring this out in the book, The Washington Operator.
I agree with you. I read a book, I won't say which one it was, where actually the president, the person that was running for the president of the United States, was an ISIS person that was going to win. And it was like, oh, my God, that is so scary. Because you don't know. I mean, it bothers me, too, that this could happen. And it bothers me, too, that someday somebody may run for president and actually not be American, say he is American, and take over the government. That's even more scary. I don't know.
Well, it is scary, Fran, because what we're focused on is two things. One, I've just said, and it's at the heart of the Washington Operator, that a huge amount of foreign money is coming into the United States to influence what our government does. Okay, that's fact one. Fact number two is our American presidential elections are influenced to a considerable extent by money. Who has the most money? Who can spend the most money?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you put those two facts together, it's not at all unrealistic to say that that foreign money, that a foreign government would be influencing what happens to in the U.S. presidential election. And so that's really kind of something that that we have to deal with extensively. Now, that takes us back to the prior book, the first Kelly Cameron book, which you, of course, very nicely reviewed, called Washington Power Play, because in Washington Power Play, the Chinese have selected a U.S. official who is in collusion with them, General Cartwright, and they are trying to influence the election of General Cartwright to be U.S. president. Cartwright is not on the payroll of the Chinese in Washington Power Play. However, Cartwright is very sympathetic to the Chinese position on some world issues. He believes that if he can be president, he will influence the Chinese. He will be able to make for a better world, for a better United States. But at the heart of it is the fact the Chinese will be influencing a U.S. presidential election, and that's what happens in Washington Power Play. And then Kelly Cameron ends up in the middle of this thing, and it's her job to try to thwart General Cartwright. So the point you're making, Fran, is right on point about foreign governments trying to influence U.S. presidential elections. You are absolutely right on point, Fran.
Well, then they said that about this one, too, and it didn't get too far because for some reason he managed to skate, what can I tell you? So we have this poor professor that's killed. I felt so bad. And the guy that's helping him winds up in the wind also. So how does that affect things, and how does Lu deal with the fact that with President Ming in his country, how does he deal with that too?
Right.
But then we've got the guy Kamal that's gone. I like that guy too. I felt bad for him, and the guy he sent to handle it. Well, what can I say? You have to be careful, people, when you do things like this, because just because they tell you to do it doesn't mean they're going to quiet you down and get rid of you so that you can't tell.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right, and the strings are being pulled from Beijing by the Chinese ruler and by the Chinese president. But he has these agents working in the United States, and they are doing his bidding in the United States. And as you said, Professor Kamal is married to a very smart woman, and she's finally has one interest, trying to save herself. At the end of the book, I don't want to tell the reader how that comes out, whether she manages to save herself or not. But she's a pretty smart person, and she dominates her husband, and I think that's kind of important. because
that's
Kamala
so cool.
is sort of pushed. Yeah, he's pushed every which way. And he has some skeletons in his closet in the Washington Operator, and ultimately he's done in by those skeletons in his closet. So I think that's what happened to him. So at any rate.
You see, guys, you cannot be whipped. You have to have a mind of your own and don't let people pull your strings, but she did. He did. So we met another character that I'm not crazy about, and that's her boss, Nicole Richards. She doesn't like Kelly, and she gives her a hard time. So what happens when Kelly meets her former boss? How do they work together, or they don't? I don't like her at all.
Oh, that's a good... Yeah, she's actually a good character, yeah. She had been Weller's boss, and so she's CIA, and she ends up clashing with Kelly. And this is kind of interesting, because one of the things I wanted to bring out in the Washington Operator, in this part of the Washington Operator, is that the CIA and the FBI often they're supposedly working together, but mm-hmm. often those two agencies clash because it's all personalities, of course, and it's fights over turf and who's going to be in charge of an investigation. And so you often end up in situations mm-hmm. where those two agencies end up clashing. And that's one of the things I want to bring out with Nicole and with Kelly. And Nicole figures she knows the turf. She knows more about international affairs than Kelly. Kelly's an FBI agent. She's domestic. She has no business messing around in these international affairs. But this is where Nicole's expertise is. Now, here comes the interesting twist. As we've said, Kelly, of course, is currently carrying on a romance that develops in this book with Richard Weller, former CIA agent. But Richard Weller had a past relationship with Nicole, who is a married woman, and Weller and Nicole had a relationship when they were both working in the Middle East. So I love this part of the book when Nicole comes in, is drawn into the discussions about what to do about Corbin.
Mm.
The first time that Kelly and Nicole meet, it's in a meeting between CIA people and FBI people, and Weller's there, and Kelly's there, and Nicole's there, and Kelly can sense, Kelly's pretty smart, she can sense there's a sexual tension and a former sexual relationship between Nicole and Weller, and Kelly's antenna goes up, and she's really kind of angry and annoyed at Weller, and Weller says, well, wait a minute, that was in my past with Nicole. And Kelly's not sure whether she should believe him or not. And Nicole's a pretty attractive woman. And so this ends up creating some real sparks between Weller and Nicole. I hope you like that part of the book, Fran, because I enjoyed writing it, the relationship between
I
the two of them
stuff.
Over Weller.
I love that stuff. Because at least it changes the pace. It changes what the book, and it lightens it up, sort of, and I like, who's going to win this, the guy or the girl? Is she going to get one over on him? Which is really good. I enjoyed that part.
Well, you made a very good point that you just made, because when you're writing a book like this, it's a sort of meant to be a serious book, and although it's meant to be entertaining as well, but you can't just continue the pace. It's sort of high level of, you know, tension and killing and so forth. And you need to sort of to lighten it up. You need humanity, and you have to try to introduce the characters and round them out and make sure that they kind of come off as real people. I mean, they have romances, they have real realistic stuff, and so that's kind of what happened and what's at the heart of this book.
That is so true. So tell us about Ali and his illness and why Esther is involved and her Koha contacts.
Okay, well, this I had a lot of fun creating in the book, The Washington Operator. At the time of the Iranian Revolution in 1979 that deposed Shaw. At that time, there was a romance between two young people who were both college students at Tehran University. One was Esther, who was Jewish and from a family that had lived in Iran. Of course, they call it Persia, had lived in Persia for 2,500 years. And she has a romance with Ali, who's not Jewish. He's from a secular Muslim family. Mm. His father is with the Iranian oil company. His family is in with the Shah, and they're well off financially in Iran. And the two of them are both students in the university, and they fall in love. And then the Iranian Revolution occurs. The Shah is, of course, ousted, and the Jews are forced to flee from Iran. And so Esther, Ali assists Esther. Her family didn't want to believe the revolution was coming, didn't want to believe that it would adversely influence Jews, waited until it was almost too late to leave, and then Ali helps them leave, and they escape to Israel. Now, over the intervening 40 years, they're 20 years old at the time, 18, 20 years old, those two sustain their relationship. Ali is recruited by a professor to become involved in the Iranian Foreign Service. And Ali then ends up he is sent abroad to Europe from time to time for his work. And as a result of them doing that, he and Esther continue their relationship, seeing each other from time to time. She never marries, but the two of them continue their relationship. And this becomes critical to the book because she becomes a Mossad agent in Israel. She wants to get back and strike at the Iranians for what they did to her family. Mm-hmm. So she joins the Mossad. Ali is playing a pivotal role in being at the heart of this conspiracy between Iran and China. And so the two of them are then drawn back with their relationship into working with Kelly and the United States and trying to thwart what's happening. And I don't want to say any more about how they do it, but just to say that their 40-year-old romance becomes pivotal to this novel and what happens to Kelly Cameron.
I love books about the Mossad. I'm fascinated by how they're amazing and how Israel gets the job done and they don't even ask, they just do it. And I often wonder if our army should have a little bit more of their training because they just manage to get it done. What can I say? It's amazing.
Yeah, they do manage to get it done, right. And she's a pretty courageous woman, Esther.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, this doesn't look like anybody's grandmother. I mean, she may be, late 50s, 60-year-old woman, but she's a pretty powerful character and pretty strong-willed and knows exactly what she wants as well. And so she ends up really kind of clashing to some extent with Kelly Cameron and with Nicole, so it's clashing with the U.S. people involved because she's determined to do things the way she wants to, and she's determined to try and save her longtime boyfriend, Ali. She wants to have a long-term relationship with him, and I don't want to tell your listeners how it works out, but that's kind of critical for her is to have that relationship with Ali, and that's what she wants to have.
Well, before I forget, and I don't want to forget, Monday should be extremely interesting. The author of Confessions of an Innocent Man, David R. Dow, will be here to talk about his book, which is based on the death penalty. What happens when someone is convicted of murder, the death penalty, in death row, and doesn't belong there? And we're going to talk about the Texas Innocent Network. He works to help people that are on death row get off. This should be extremely interesting with what's going on in the news. And I have to decide if I'm going to ask that question about something. On the 14th, we have Saddle Up for Murder, the Fiona Quinn series with Cindy McDonald. On the 20th, we have Jeff Bond, Black Quest 40. On the 22nd, Cy Weiss, An Eye for a Lie. And on the 27th, somebody you might know, Jason Allen, East End. And on the 29th, Jim Nesmith, The Best Lousy Decision I Ever Made. And on September 10th, Alan Topol, Vincent Zandri, Larry Thompson, and Matt Coyle. We're going to talk about different types of publishing, different types of way of presenting a book, and why Fran won't read a book with small font. Seriously. I have been getting like 30 or 40 books at a time, and when the book has a font that's smaller than the smallest letter of the alphabet on a one font, I toss it. So we're going to talk about how books are presented and why publishers are putting out books of 200-300 pages or 150 pages of small font. So when all the parties, how does the President of the United States in your book, when it gets finally moved in, and the demands are made by Esther Massad, what does he do? How does he finally feel when he knows what's going on?
Well, he's, of course, at the heart of the book. Near the end, he's drawn in because when the Forrester, Kelly's boss, presents him with evidence, here's what China and Iran are planning to do. Then it becomes, you know, the old expression with the White House, of course, the president, the buck stops there. Well, that's where it stops. And so at the end of the day, it's the U.S. president who's brought in. And what's he going to do about this China and Iranian conspiracy to take over Saudi Arabia and the Saudi oil fields? And is he going to respond militarily? Is he going to come to the aid of the Saudi Arabians? Mm-hmm. Is he going to let China and Iran do what they want to do? That really ultimately is his decision. And, you know, I've gotten really quite a few emails and letters from people who have said to me that, you know, it really is kind of creative on your part bringing together China and Iran against the United States. How did you think of this? And my answer is, I hate to say this, but it really isn't that all that creative. I won't say it's obvious, mm-hmm. but here, let's talk about the ingredients for a minute. China and Iran mm-hmm. are both doing battle with the United States in different ways right now. And of course, all the Chinese trade wars and everything else, Iran, we're having the business with the oil tankers. And so those two are both locked in different kind of battles with the United States. At the same time, oil is critical to both China and Iran. For Iran, it's the money. It's their economic lifeblood comes through oil. For China, they desperately need oil. So for those two to come together over the subject of oil, isn't that really far-fetched? And then the other thing you have to look at, a long view of history, is China and, let's not call them Iran, let's call them Persia, the name that the country had for thousands of years until the 20th century. China and Iran are two long-time great civilizations who are both wanting to be on the rebound and become dominant again in the world or in their part of the world. So for these two longtime great civilizations to come together, again, is not surprising. History has changed. The United States can be on top today. Britain mm-hmm. was on top for a long time. And where are they now? They're on life support. So it yeah. would seem the United States has been dominant for a long time. Are we going to stay dominant forever? No, of course not. That's what history is. And so now we have the rising Chinese and Iranians wanting to do battle with the U.S., and that's at the heart of the Washington operator, and then they enlist Corbin, the venal guy, and, hey, that's my plot. And somebody could pick up those pieces, and I guess they could try to write the book, I suppose. Anyhow.
I often wonder, I just wrote a note to myself, this is what I do sometimes, that I know what you're saying, that sometimes they're not going to be on top. I often wonder if it matters that the leadership of our government needs to be more aware of the fact that we need to stay on top, and they need to work with the American people and Congress in order to be able to do the right thing for the American people and keep us on top, or if they're even aware of what they're doing sometimes, I wonder.
Well, I think that's right, and that's kind of to at the heart of my book, The Washington Operator, because, you know, as we were saying, Fran, I've been in Washington a long time. I've seen how our government operates or doesn't operate, as the case may be, and I try to put that stuff into my books, and it really becomes a pivotal part of The Washington Operator. Hey, who's doing what in Washington? Who really knows what they're doing? Who doesn't know what they're doing? How do people and individual and personal motives end up into it? And then, you know, you get a guy like Corbin, and Corbin has his own personal motives. He needs money. He has his lifestyle. He has his three former wives. He has his Hollywood starlet. But he's not different than people that you've read about in the newspapers in the last in the last few years. Not at all. Maybe a little more evil, but hey, you know, somebody once wrote a column, I think I may have shared this with you, is pity the poor Washington novelist, because here we are, we have to try to come up with plots that are sufficiently interesting and creative when what's happening in the news and what's on the front page is pretty traumatic, and we have to write our plots that are more creative. And we have to make them creative so that the reader doesn't say, oh, this is what I read about in the newspaper. So we've got to be more creative. We have to work harder. We have to come up with a plot that the reader will say, hey, I haven't read about this. I didn't think about this. But yet utilizing realistic characters. So, I don't know, you won't feel sorry for me, but some people might say, pity the Washington novelist, because he has a tougher job now with all this stuff going on.
I know, but it makes it more interesting because of it. You see, people just have to know. So for those people that, you know, I'm getting tired of, you know, Kirkus Vermeck recommends things and RT book reviews. So Just Reviews, that's me. At the end of every show, I recommend books that people should read. Some of them are out and some of them are not out because I get them beforehand. So Washington Operator by Alan Topol, definitely buy 1,000 copies of. I just interviewed on Monday The Dead Girl in 2A by Carter Wilson. That was phenomenal. Coming out next week on Friday, Old Bones by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. That was absolutely fantastic. Somebody we all know and love, John Land, A Time for Murder, is coming out in December, but I'm reading it now. And coming out October 1st, she's coming on my show, Tess Gerrinson, Shape of Night, and she wrote sort of like a paranormal. The character falls in love with a ghost, and I won't tell you what else happens between her and the ghost. And those are some of the books that Just Reviews think that everybody should read, especially The Washington Operator. So tell us how the Mossad operates and more about the coup. How can it be stopped, and will there be more of Lou and Kelly Cameron in the next novel, I hope? He's dangerous, but I like him.
Well, yes, there will be. There will be. The Mossad, as you said, is sort of at the heart of the book. And I've done a lot of Mossad reading, and I've worked them into a number of my novels. And here they play not a major role. It's not a Mossad novel. It's a Washington novel. But they're important. And as you said, their ability to gather information, their resources, what they can do is pretty significant. And so they are worked into the book and play a pivotal role. Kelly Cameron, I liked a lot, and working on the next book, I definitely need a role for Kelly Cameron. But, and you and I have talked about this, is you know, it's good to keep going with the same character a certain amount, and the readers become attached to that character, which is good. But on the other hand, as an author, when you have a single character and you continue to use that character, it becomes a challenge because the character has to develop from book to book and be different in each book. Otherwise, you're writing the same thing and the same character. But the other thing that I find is I want to create new characters, and I want to create new heroes. And I won't say it's lazy to keep using the same character because the character, you can have them develop. He or she can do different things. But on the other hand, there's a lot of fun in developing brand new characters. So I like Kelly a lot, and I think we'll continue with Kelly. But I got to bring in some very new characters in my next book because I don't want the readers to think I'm getting stale, and because I myself have more fun creating new characters. So we'll sort of see where we go with Kelly. But I'm glad you like her. I like her a lot, too. I think she is a terrific character. And, you know, will she and Weller have a future? Well, you know, to be determined, as they say, TBD. But and I like the idea, and I've gotten positive feedback on this. Her 10-year-old, well, I guess she's 12 in this book, her daughter is a bit of a handful. And I love doing these mother-daughter relationships. The daughter is interested in being an actress and has a major part in the play Oklahoma, which Kelly almost misses the one performance because she's involved in the shenanigans in this novel. But I love the relationship between Kelly and her granddaughter. It just so happens I have a granddaughter who's involved in the theater and who's about the age of Kelly's Kelly's granddaughter, and I mean Kelly's daughter, and my granddaughter is convinced that I modeled Kelly's daughter after her, and so she's a cute kid. I give her the parts of the drafts to read about the granddaughter and what the granddaughter. I mean, what the daughter? I give my granddaughter the parts of the draft to read about Kelly's daughter, and I say, "What do you think about this?" And she's happy to help me correct dialogue and say, "No, no, I wouldn't say this." I said, "Well, hey, Jessica, the novel's not about you." But she says, "I wouldn't say this." But that interplay between Kelly and her daughter, I enjoy. And I'm sure that's 100% accurate because I had some expertise here. I had my own granddaughter weigh in on this who's interested in the theater. That was fun.
My niece is doing that also. As a matter of fact, she tried out for voice and almost got the third chair, but the chairs, but she got nervous on the third one. But she's going to Las Vegas to interview for some television program after she graduates high school. And I said to her, "I really think you should do it, and I really think you should try. And then when you come back, go to college, because you said you want to be a reading specialist like your aunt. Better idea." So I'm hoping she follows in my footsteps. But you know what? They got the bug. I can't say anything. She sings. She's gorgeous. And she sings okay. She's not great. I don't know how her acting ability would be, but whatever. And we're going to continue with Kelly and her relationship with Wella. But what about Julie? How is she going to fit into this? She's a cute kid, like you said. And basically, if it's a child that's speaking, it should be like come from a child, you know, how the child was. How does she feel about him? Because he's not her father.
Right. Yep. She's, that's correct. She's not her father. But Kelly's marriage ended up. She was married to a hard-working, hard-driving, workaholic Washington lawyer, and her husband at some point decided that he didn't want to be married anymore. He didn't want to live in Washington. He wanted to get off of the Washington rat race. He wanted to go to Maine and farm. So they get a divorce, and he's really not interested in Julie, in his daughter. He's happy to turn her over to Kelly, and so there's really no relationship there between Julie and the father because the father sort of opted out. And at the end of the novel, The Washington Operator, we see that that Weller is trying to reach out to Julie and try to create a relationship with Julie, and that adds a kind of a humanity to the whole movement, to the whole story. And we'll have to see where that goes and whether they can pull off that that relationship. But Weller is a good guy. He's smart, never been married before, been involved with the CIA. And so it's, you know, that's, for him, it would be a first kind of family relationship.
Well, I was a step-parent for 14 years, a long time ago. And I met my stepson when he was 3. And he lived with us because he called me one day and he said, "I'm coming to live with you because I can't take it here anymore." He lived in a big house that was rich and he decided to live in the Bronx. And I said, "If you want to come with me, not a problem." And he did for 10 years until we separated or whatever. And that was the saddest day of my life because it was the most fun. And as well as anything like me, it's the most fun. I mean, I never knew when he was going to have his 97 teenage friends over at 10 o'clock at night when I came home from my second job cooking steak on my table. No, I'm serious. And you never knew what you were going to find. And you know what? It's a great experience. But you have to be the kind of person that doesn't mind, you know, taking care of someone else's child. But he considered me his mother. He called me Fran, but he considered me his mother. So maybe Weller will be like me. You never know.
Exactly.
So what is next for you, and where can we learn more about you and your work?
Okay,
and are you bringing Craig Page back
next?
Soon, I hope?
I don't know if I'm bringing Craig Page back. Hey, what about Antonio Ferrari I may bring to you next? Antonio Ferrari and a world-famous piano player. And,
oh, nice.
Something happens when they are on vacation in Corsica, and the Russian president may have been behind what happens to them. So that's where I think I'm headed next. So I will introduce you to Antonio Ferrari. I will introduce you to his wonderful girlfriend, who is a world-class piano player named Chiara, who's Italian, and that's where I think I'm headed with you next. Now, as far as this work, people can get my book on Amazon. We made a major change with my agent and I.
Mm-hmm.
We have decided to go, and this is the subject of your book talk the next time, Fran, but
yep.
So I'll be able to comment on it. We decided to go exclusively with Amazon on this book for both paper and Kindle. And that was that's a basic change too for me. So it I know that's the subject of your next talk, and so I'm going to look forward to participating, and I could share my own experiences.
It's going to be interesting, and I really wish people would write books with larger fonts so Fran could read them. I mean, really, seriously. And when you say concert pianist and piano player, that was my major in college, was music and piano. So,
really?
That is great.
I never knew that.
You know, it's funny. My nephew didn't know that, and he asked me something. What did you major in college? I said, piano and violin. And I was a concert pianist, and the violin, I love playing since I'm a kid, and I can't do it anymore. But that's beside the point. I did. I majored in music, and I can't sing. And I had to do a program, and I won't tell you what 4 songs I sang in order to pass because it was hilarious. The music professor knew I can't sing, and my sister was alive.
Then you're gonna love this book, Fran. Really?
Yes, I am.
I'm inspired by my wife, who plays piano 2 hours a day. So
that's great.
So attend music festival in Aspen. So you're gonna love this book, Fran. Then here we go. I never knew you had this piano interest. Okay, there we are.
I'm a music major, and I graduated with a music degree because you couldn't major in education in Hunter College, so I had a minor in education, which was more credits than the major in music, which was forever. Every class was like I have a credit, but I couldn't sing, and the professor felt sorry for me. So you had to get up in front of a whole group of 200 people Seriously? And with a program, and I won't tell you what I got up there and sang. It was an original. And they're still talking about it.
Oh,
my
God. Good for you.
Yeah,
that's
I sang four nursery rhymes on key. For real.
Good for you. Congratulations.
I sang Frere Jacques, Row, Row, Row Your Boat, Mary Had a Little Lamb, and Humpty Dumpty. I'm serious. And for an encore, I sang the Incy Weensy Spider. And they clapped because I didn't make a mistake. So anyway, I want to thank you so much. This has been fun. And September 10th, I will remind everybody, is the panel show with you, Vincent Zandri, Larry Thompson, and Matt Coyle. This should be interesting. So everybody, have a great day. Alan, thank you so much. Have a great day, everybody, and bye.
Really loved it. Thanks, friend. Bye-bye.